One of the best books we got last year was a little volume of short stories called The Shell Collector. Here's how it begins. The ophthalmologist knew the boy was blind as soon as he walked through the door. Rather than examine him, what was left to examine, the doctor pulled off the boy's shoes and walked him out the back door, down a sandy lane, onto a spit of beach. The boy had never seen sea, and he struggled to absorb it. It was wading ankle-deep when his toes came upon a small round shell that the boy truly was changed. His fingers dug the shell up. He felt the sleek egg of its body, the toothy gap of its aperture. "That's a mouse cowrie," the doctor said. "Lovely find. Has brown spots and darker stripes at its base like tiger stripes. You can't see it, can you?" But he could. He'd never seen anything so clearly in his life. He had never felt anything so smooth, had never imagined something could possess such deep polish. He asked, nearly whispering, "Who made this?" The shell was still in his hand a week later when his father pried it out, complaining of the stink. "It's from the beginning of The Shell Collector, the title story in Anthony Doerr's prize-winning collection of short stories. Doerr's characters are people who know the natural world in a way the rest of us can barely imagine. Like the blind man, who can identify the smallest shells by touch." Doerr told Anne Strainchamps, "That particular story has its roots in Kenya."
The shelling there is just incredible. It's amazing. We'd go out to these little islands where there are actually no trees. They're basically sandbars, and you'd just be made of shells. You know, you could just filter through them, just these beautiful little shells.
And what kind of shells? I mean, sort of really exotic, interesting shells, or mostly plainer?
Plainer, you know, most of them are broken, you know, like periwinkles and nerites and shells that you see a lot. But, well, in tropical seas, you know, I grew up in Cleveland, so all that was just so different for me. And they're just so beautiful. When I was growing up, my parents would drive us down to Florida for a couple of weeks each spring. You know, we'd go down for spring break or whatever. And we'd go to a place called Sanibel Island, which when we were kids is a little less spoiled than it is now. And the shelling there was just exquisite. It was so beautiful. So I think part of that, you know, this story was just an excuse to go back and look through shell books and feel shells and stuff.
I'm leaving for Sanibel Island in 2 days.
All right. Outstanding. Oh,
yeah,
great.
And I remember the first time I ever went there, the shells are just incredible.
Yeah.
You know, as you said, you can lift up handfuls. But I've always wondered, it's magical to me every time I go back, and I've wondered what it is for people about shells. There's something so just magical and enticing, and you can never get enough of them. You can't stop looking. You don't even look at the sea when the shells are there.
I know. You kind of lose yourself and spend hours just looking down, and I don't know. I'm glad other people feel that way, you know, but hopefully it's a common kind of thing. I mean, they're just so beautiful to hold. And I thought that was interesting about making the guy blind, because they're such a tactile experience, shells. And although, you know, there's a lot of colors and stuff to them as well, just feeling them. So sometimes writing the story, I'd actually, you know, close my eyes and have a shell in my hand.
I was wondering, I thought it must be really challenging to write about how you would perceive a shell if you couldn't see it, if you were just perceiving it through your sense of touch.
Yeah. Yeah, that's just what I did. In fact, I remember afterward walking around the apartment and still being in the mindset that I was blind and being like, remember, you can see now. You can pour your coffee. It's funny.
Now, in this particular story, at the center of the story is a particular shell, also a cone shell. Well, you should tell the story instead of me.
I kind of hyped up the frequency of cone shells in that area, obviously, because they're a pretty dangerous shell and can be fatal if you get the large one and the wrong one. But yeah, that's kind of what the story hinges on. And the shell collector is trying to avoid them. But I remember reading something about the toxins in cone venom being used to attempt to cure or at least alleviate paralysis in stroke victims. So who knows how much of that is still even going on or if it worked. But I kind of decided that it would be interesting to imbue those toxins with a healing and restorative power, whether or not they really are there. So in the beginning of the story, a woman with a severe case of malaria is accidentally cured by being bitten by one of those shells.
So you've got something from the natural world that is incredibly powerful and is both a blessing and a curse.
Yes, exactly. And that's so interesting to try to play with and see what happens. Yeah, and it curses, unfortunately, some lives and helps others.
That's a motif that shows up in a number of the stories. I mean, I'm thinking of the hunter's wife, for instance. Again, there's this woman, the hunter's wife, finds something powerful and magical, comes from the natural world, and it is in her life and in the hunter's life a blessing and a curse.
Right. Well, it's, I guess it's kind of corny to describe, but when there's a sleeping animal or a recently killed or dead animal, she can put her hand on it and feel its soul departing or sense its dreams in a sense. And she learns later that she can actually do this with humans as well. And so that's what drives the wedge between her and her husband, whose job is to take people out into the woods and kill things.
But the way you write about it, it's is lyrical. You should read some from this.
I'm happy to. Winter threw itself at the cabin. He took her out every day. He showed her 1,000 ladybugs hibernating in an orange ball hung in a riverbank hollow, a pair of dormant frogs buried in frozen mud, their blood crystallized until spring. He pried a globe of honeybees from its hive, slow buzzing, stunned from the sudden exposure, each bee shimmying for warmth. When he placed the globe in her hands, she fainted, her eyes rolled back. Later, lying there, she saw all their dreams at once, the winter reveries of scores of worker bees, each one fiercely vivid, bright trails through thorns to a clutch of wild roses, honey tidally brimming 100 combs. With each day, she learned more about what she could do. She felt a foreign and keen sensitivity bubbling in her blood, as though a seed planted long ago was just now sprouting. The larger the animal, the more powerfully it could shake her. The recently dead were virtual mines of visions, casting them off with a slow fading strength, like a long series of tethers being cut one by one. She pulled off her mittens and touched everything she could, bats, salamanders, a cardinal chick tumbled from its nest, still warm. 10 hibernating garter snakes coiled beneath a rock, eyelids sealed, tongues stilled. Each time she touched some frozen insect, some slumbering amphibian, anything just dead, her eyes rolled back and its visions, its heaven, went shivering through her body.
There's such a sense of the richness and the abundance of nature in that passage and really in most of that story. Where does that come from for you?
It just comes from an innate love to be outside. I think I feel a lot more comfortable when I'm outside. Just growing up, you know, taking walks and doing lots of backpacking with my folks and my brothers, and I still just need to be outside. And for me, writing, one of the greatest things about writing is being able to explore things I'm interested in. So in a lot of ways, it's just ways to research things. In that story of the Hunter's Wife, a lot of the genesis of that was just researching hibernation and torpor and getting to see what animals do during the winter.
Have you ever had anything approaching a kind of mystical experience in nature?
I guess not. I can remember I did some climbing in Alaska, and I can remember ascending a peak there. I was pretty young. I was maybe 17. I remember looking out and being like, this is the most beautiful thing I've ever seen in the world. It's just white peaks all the way to the horizon. That sticks out. But nothing so much mystical as it's more restorative for me. You know, if I feel like I need to get outside, then I get out there and I feel better about everything. Yeah.
In a lot of the descriptions of the natural world or the stories in which you're describing landscapes, there's often some sadness or some loss. And I'm wondering if, for you, the beauty of the natural world is often tinged with sadness or loss.
Sure. It's interesting. A field biologist could tell you this better, but, I mean, anytime you're paying attention to things outside, there's all kinds of violence and death going on all around you. You know, if you turn up a log, there's, you know, ants raiding some dead beetle's body, you know, and there's always so many rough and just fatal circumstances unfolding all around you if you're paying attention. All these small predations going on all the time outside. So I think that's part of it. I mean, it's definitely not something to be glorified as much as just try to be as objective about it as you can.
Yeah, because I was thinking, you know, you've got the one story about the shell collector in which at the center there's a shell that kills people.
Right,
And there's a really strong sense in that story that the oceans are dangerous. I mean, it made me think twice about going wading in the ocean.
Yeah, well, I think that I have that sense too. I mean, anytime you're, especially in a tropical ocean, you know, those seas are pretty venomous, you know, and of course you can go days and days without ever encountering any of that stuff, but...
But is that really real? It really is dangerous to go wading and
oh, sure, gosh, yeah. Well, cone snails can be fatal, and they're stonefish, and I kind of cataloged some of those in that story.
What's a stonefish?
It's a ugly little fish that can kill people as well. It has like a fatal toxin in its bite. And there's lionfish out there with those. They're beautiful. They have these flowing, like crenellated fins, and they can sting people pretty badly too. And Portuguese man of war, and you know, electric eels. Sure.
Did you go in the water anyway when you were living in Kenya?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, you know, it's not as. I kind of hype it up a little bit, but certainly you got to be careful when you're out there. There's even fire coral. There's coral that stings awfully. It's like being stung by bees.
Have you ever been stung by it?
Definitely. It's horrible.
Do you also worry? I mean, it seems like you do from the stories that the kind of intense awareness and oneness with a landscape, that's kind of dying out of our culture, that we glorify nature, but we don't really live it.
Yeah, I worry about that, definitely. I worry about that just in my own life more than anything. And you know, can you go to Starbucks in the morning and still, I mean, just all of us as Americans, as citizens in the world, have such an impact. You know, we carry this invisible baggage of all our refuse and garbage and fossil fuel burning. And I just hope, and I feel like people still do deep down, even if they live in a skyscraper and don't go outside all day, still have an affinity for sky and the natural world. And, you know, I try not to make the stories didactic in any way, but I worry that, you know, the natural world's imperiled and that literature may be one way to help preserve it and maybe even create more of it in a sense, in an imaginary sense.
Anthony Doerr talking with Anne Strainchamps. His short story collection is called The Shell Collector. It's just out in paper.